Welcome to the ARUG Zen Center podcast. Our talks and discussions are offered for free to anyone who is interested in the ancient wisdom tradition of Zen. If you find these recordings to be of benefit, please consider donating to ARUG through our website, www.zenwave.org. Thank you for listening and for your kind support.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Everybody here in person on Zoom. Thank you for joining us. So today we are continuing the exploration of Shantideva's teachings from the book The Way of the Bodhisattva with the commentaries from Pema Chodron. And the book itself, just a quick note, the book itself contains many short verses, but for our study sessions, we will work with the sections that mostly pertain to the theme of our Ango. The whole thing pertains to it, but we pick particular sections that fit better. And during our last session, we discussed, if you remember, the vital importance of cultivating an ability to remain still and silent when we experience harmful states of mind. In this next section, Shantideva unpacks this further by looking at how we can tame our mind and develop a strong resolve through working with ourselves and with others. So this is verse 47. When you feel the wish to walk about or even to express yourself in speech, first examine what is in your mind, for they will act correctly who have stable mind. So, commentary. You've decided to meditate for 45 minutes and you're 15 minutes into your sitting. Suddenly, you remember something important that you must do. Dunzi has entered the picture. If you fail to acknowledge that tug as just a tug or the thought as just thinking, you'll find yourself watering the plants or checking your email. Instead, the initial urge to walk about or phone someone can simply be acknowledged. Without praise or blame, you can touch these thoughts, let them go, and come back to taming your mind. So she says, come back to taming your mind. This is actually taming your mind, right? To acknowledge, just to acknowledge and not follow the thought, you're taming your mind. And it's probably good to note here that when we don't do that, when we follow, we go in the opposite direction. We give in and we strengthen something. So we always weaken something and strengthen something. So when we get up and go and say, I got to do something right now, and it's most important, and I follow that thought, then I weaken my resolve and I strengthen my habit, the habit of being a slave to my thoughts and emotions, right? So when I don't do that, I weaken the habit and I strengthen my resolve. I strengthen my connection with wisdom, we can say. So continuing, with perfect and unyielding faith, with steadfastness, respect, and courtesy, with modesty and conscientiousness, work calmly for the happiness of others. So now this is bringing others into the picture, right? Others are always there, but this is bringing others in a more vital, actualized way. And commentary, these are the general instructions for gathering virtue. Now she says, I noticed that Western students sometimes wince at the word virtue. Virtue here means cultivating qualities that resonate with rather than block enlightened mind. Right? So resonate with rather than block enlightened mind. Right? So we want to develop certain abilities, certain virtues or cultivate certain aspects of our being that naturally correspond with an enlightened mind. Enlightened mind is not something to go seek or something to get from somewhere. It's something to realize, right? So those aspects may be dormant or may be covered up by strong or thick layer of habits. So to resonate with that, we awaken that in us, then it starts to pick up momentum. So even in conventional thinking, she says, basic warmth and open-mindedness are considered virtues. Basic warmth and open-mindedness are considered virtues. They are qualities that connect us with others rather than push us apart. Although they are always available to us, we can help the process along by cultivating them. Sadly, we're already quite skilled at cultivating qualities that block our basic goodness. Nevertheless, we can easily become accomplished in gathering virtue. Now, you can see the connection between what she's saying and the importance of knowing how to stay still and silent, right? Because when we don't stay still and silent, we are continuing to cultivate something else, the opposite of that, right? And we move further away from, right? Because we automatically give in to the knee-jerk reactivities, and then quelling that, we give wisdom a chance to arise. Often the quickness of our reactivity doesn't allow wisdom to manifest because we're so quick to react that wisdom just gets pushed aside. So this is so important to examine again and again the quickness of our reactivity. The Tibetan word, she says, for virtue is gewa. Some common examples of gewa are non-aggression, love and compassion. Shantideva also lists the qualities of faith, steadfastness, respect, courtesy, modesty, conscientiousness, and calmness. Some of these qualities require some explanation. In Buddhism, there are many kinds of faith. One example is eager faith. We all want to de-escalate our suffering when we see that we can create the causes for contentment instead of misery, we become extremely eager to do so. Another example is confident faith, which is based on confidence in bodhicitta. We have faith in the basic goodness. We have faith that basic goodness is within us. This jewel may be buried, right, or forgotten, but it is always present and available to all of us. We feel confident that we can find it, nurture it, and bring it out. Confidence and eagerness work together. This is the faith, or gewa, that Shantideva refers to. The faith that we can do it. Right? So it is something that is within. We have to trust. We have to trust that it is within our capacity. Even if we feel stuck, even if we feel overwhelmed by our habits, right? Even if we tried many times and fell on our face many times, still, we have to maintain the trust that it is within our capacity. Now, steadfastness is another virtue Shantideva mentions. This is cultivated in our meditation practice. No matter what, sick or well, tired or alert, in good or bad weather, we train in being present and awake to whatever occurs. So, and that includes knowing how to regulate emotions. It has to include that, right? Because if we don't know how to regulate emotions, the emotions will take over, right? That's naturally what happens, right? So we have to know how to regulate that, and then no matter what, we develop that ability, that capacity that we have to maintain the resolve, to stay on the path, to maintain the practice, or to keep strengthening the practice as we go. So we train in being present and awake to whatever occurs. And that includes everything in our lives, obviously. With faith and steadfastness, we stick with ourselves through all kinds of moods and states of mind. Maybe I'll say that again. With faith and steadfastness, we stick with ourselves through all kinds of moods and states of mind. Whatever the mood is, it doesn't matter. It's not that we ignore it, but it doesn't matter in terms of maintaining course, it doesn't matter in terms of maintaining the cultivation of being present. So being present to that particular state of mind is practicing being present. It's not just being present to what I like or to days where it's sunny outside. Could you please see who is there? Yeah, right? So it's not just being present based on likes and dislikes. It's being present, period, to whatever occurs. And then these virtues, qualities are gentle and unbiased. Everything and everyone is included. Right? So we develop respect and courtesy for ourselves and others. Now, the quality of modesty or humility comes naturally when we are attentive. So I'm going to finish this part of the commentary, and I'd like to have a short discussion about that, right? So the quality of modesty or humility comes naturally when we are attentive. What does that mean? When we see how reactive and unkind we can be. Again, when we see how reactive and unkind we can be. So it means we have to become aware, right? Be attentive to the fact that we are reacting, and that those reactivities lead to unkind behavior. Right? So when we see that, this humbles us considerably. Instead of causing despair, however, this painful realization can connect us with the tenderness of bodhicitta. Modesty or humbleness is the opposite of armoring ourselves. It allows us to be receptive and hear what others have to say. Right? Again, being present, right? If we're not present, how can we hear others? If we're not present, actually, what we hear is ourselves. We do hear, we hear ourselves. And what we do is we hear what we think about others or about the situation. And we somehow confuse that with thinking that we are actually listening to other people. Yes, what's going on?
They wanted to come for the discussion on the tissue, but they're late.
Bring cushions, yes, of course, and serve them tea. It allows us to be receptive and hear what others have to say, right? Conscientiousness denotes diligence and honesty. With this virtuous quality, we can work calmly for the happiness of others. Instead of working frantically, we pace ourselves and relax. So let's scroll back a little bit and look at that line. When she says, the quality of modesty or humility comes naturally when we are attentive. Do you connect with that? Does that make sense? What does that mean? What does it mean? The quality of modesty or humility comes naturally when we are attentive. Anyone? Yes?
Can you please serve me tea? Something I'm kind of tangled up in with this is conversations around reactivity. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like when I'm in line with myself, I'm reacting and I'm not hesitating. And in line, you know, behaving in line with my true self or, you know, with the greater situation. But I often catch myself sometimes when I'm engaged in that, I'm reacting at the expense of a lot of other things. And that's kind of coming from a sort of place of nervousness or fight or flight or something, and I'm out of it, but it's trying to notice everyone else, or yeah, I don't know, long story short, I just went getting like really kind of tangled in there of like, I feel like reactivity is important to watch because it's born of habits, and we're not always conscious of what are, you know, quote unquote good habits or bad habits or things of that nature. But when we don't hesitate, I think there's something there to look at. And I don't know if I'm impatient, or, you know, I need to let things breathe more, because sometimes when I do slow down enough, I can kind of take a moment and let something else fill the space other than my impulse to fill the space. But I'm not really making sense.
So slowing down or being patient, right? Being patient to develop the ability to see what's going on, to be aware of constantly, not just when other people are there, right? So continuously, constantly to examine my state of mind, my state of being, right? Mm-hmm. Where am I at? Not to judge, but just to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. Simply to acknowledge, right? So I feel some crankiness, I feel tired, I feel some anger, I feel sadness, right? I experience those things. Mm-hmm. Making a note of it, right? Accepting it as it is. Also not wanting it to be otherwise. Because wanting it to be, although it's unpleasant, wanting it to be otherwise creates resistance. Resistance shuts down something, blocks us. Right. And waste energy, right? So there is that, right? So that now, that's how you go to school, right? You go to work, right? You didn't sleep that well. That's it, doesn't matter. The night is over, you wake up, right? You may be cranky, you may be tired, you may be angry, right? So still, other people are there, right? You interact with others. So what can we do is, that's the question, right? So what can we do to shift the attention to acknowledge our state of being, and then to shift the attention to the well-being of others, or just to others, right? To shift the attention to reality, first acknowledging our state of mind. Now, this is something that we, if we don't cultivate it on a regular basis, it becomes very challenging. Mm-hmm. Very challenging, right? So we have to cultivate that on a regular basis, right? All the time, attend to that, and then kind of keep the finger on the pulse. Where am I at right now? Where am I at? Where am I at? Where am I at? Constantly, mm-hmm. right? Just to acknowledge, not to judge. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I have trouble separating myself from the one who's moody. And I very often will, to the detriment of my growth, my personal growth, I will definitely go with that. So it moves, I move. And it sits and I sit. Instead of my being the captain and being like, no, this is, I know where you're at. I know what you want to do, but we're not going to do that. You know, I'm not really comfortable with leadership over my impulses, my dragons. Yeah,
right.
It's hard to separate that.
So what we're talking often about is not identifying, right? So acknowledging what is arising, but not identifying. Not identifying, period, whether it's high or low, it doesn't matter, right? Whether we feel that we are succeeding or failing, right? Whether we are gaining or losing, simply not acknowledging, but not identifying. Right? It's not that I am the one who is gaining, I'm the one who, there may be gain or loss, but I'm not the one who's gaining or losing. There may be, you know, happiness, well, there is happiness and sadness and all kinds of in between states of mind. But then if I'm not the one who is that, then I'm the one who is experiencing. Being the one who is experiencing, all I need to do is realize the space, the spaciousness for all those things to come and go freely. Then I lose the need to identify, because I recognize myself as the spaciousness, not as what comes and goes within the spaciousness. Then everything is welcome. Does that make sense? Everything is welcome, right? And then naturally, so this is what she's saying, the quality of modesty or humility comes naturally when we are attentive. When we are able to stay attentive to the moment, the situation, then naturally, well, we're not self-concerned, right? We're not self-centered. And so naturally, we will provide the moment with what it needs. Or we will be the vehicle for the whatever the moment needs to arise through. We become the vehicle for that. So we talk about being the vehicle for goodness. That's what that means. But to be the vehicle of goodness, we have to continuously know this, our state of mind. be aware of our state of mind. And then prioritize the moment, hence being present, right? Prioritize the moment over my thoughts, emotions, reactivities, connotations. The moment comes first. However it comes, that's another thing, right? The moment comes first, however it comes. So, yeah, anything else, you guys? And you guys also free to share if you want. Thank you for joining us. Go ahead.
So, when you were talking about connection, I mean, it's really easy to immediately think about isolation and the times of my life that I felt very isolated and alone. And you might think that, you know, that sense of smallness that you feel when you're isolated, well, that's humility, right? You're small, but I'm really struck by the quote because isolation feels like that delusion that just feeds that ego because mm-hmm. you kind of focus on it. And so as you lean into the connectedness, maybe you do experience a different type of small, but a small that's part of something bigger as opposed to the blinder view of that fake reality of isolation. So I definitely, you know, like there's something magical about feeling it as that bigger connectedness. So
the feeling of being small, right? Feeling small, feeling disconnected or detached, or right? Okay, so the feeling and the thought. So back, circle right back to Zazen. What do we do with that when you sit in Zazen and you practice, right? So such thoughts appear in your mind, right? Emotions. How do you meet them?
Let them be.
Right, so with silence and stillness.
Also, I think there's a value in curiosity. Mm-hmm. You know, like not in a way of pushing it away or trying to solve it, but like exploring it, you know, seeing all sides of it for a way, for a route through to wisdom, mm-hmm. through a route through to understanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So curiosity, right? So you're curious about what's going on. So when you sit in Zazen, you see that arising and vanishing, right? You see it and you're not following. Right, you're not following. Those are the basic instructions, right? Do not follow. Acknowledge, but do not follow. So then mobilizing that on the go, right? Acknowledge, but do not follow. Mm-hmm. So whatever state of mind we may experience, right? We acknowledge, but we don't follow. Not following is not giving it more energy, right? Not feeding it, nurturing it, so it's not gonna grow. It's going to stick around as long as it needs to stick around. It's going to subside when it needs to subside, right? When it runs out of the initial energy that brings it about. But we're not giving it anything to keep it going. We're just watching it, right? Now, while watching it in Zazen, the attention is on the body, right? On the breath, on just being present, right? There's no doing in that. There's no action kind of doing, right? So, and then mobilizing that, on about, same thing. But then there is a different kind of challenge because the world is constantly asking us to meet it, to do things with it, right? To interact. So it's different, right? Because there are other people. And that's where it becomes more challenging, but at the same time, it becomes energizing. Because the interactions can give us the exact nutrients that we need to deepen our practice, to deepen the wisdom, our connection to wisdom. Okay, verse 56. Let us not be downcast by the worrying wants of childish persons quarreling. Their thoughts are bred from conflict and emotion. Let us understand and treat them lovingly. Now, commentary, verse 56, makes it clear why we need to gather virtue. Virtue makes it possible for us to deal compassionately with one another. The word childish here is not used as a derogatory way, in a derogatory way. It conveys loving concern for those who, out of ignorance, continue to strengthen habits of suffering. right? So it's an important point to raise, right? It conveys loving concern for those who, out of ignorance, continue to strengthen habits of suffering. And this is always useful, right? Because we encounter all kinds of others, right? Some may be more developed spiritually, some less developed spiritually, but it conveys loving concern for everyone, right? For those out of ignorance, continue to strengthen habits of suffering. We tend to get provoked by childish persons quarreling. The energy of negativity is very seductive and draws us in, right? Shantideva's instruction here is to diffuse the charge by reflecting on why people do what they do. People who quarrel are slaves to their emotions, which we know what that feels like, right? To be a slave of our emotions. They don't choose to get angry or yell, but like all of us, they get overwhelmed by their kleshas and by their attachments and carried away. If we too get caught in the negative undertow, doesn't that put us in the same boat? Or when we get caught up, that's probably better, right? Doesn't that put us in the same boat? Instead of getting provoked by strife or scorn, wouldn't it be better to break the cycle of aggression and treat people with understanding? As we stabilize our minds, we'll see more honestly how we get incited and how difficult it is to remain like a log, right? Back to the original advice, to remain like a log when we feel this kind of states of mind or feelings. Thus, when others get snared, we treat them lovingly, just as we'd want to be treated in this same predicament. Without being condescending or disapproving, we realize our sameness and communicate from the heart. That's very, very important, right? Very important point that is being raised here. To not use other people's getting caught up or stuck as a way to separate, but to use it as a way to see sameness, to flip it around, right? Not, oh, I'm better than him or her, right? Seeing how others get caught up could be a mirror to us, because we get caught up. We may not get caught up in the same exact way, but it really doesn't matter. We get caught up either way, right? So to recognize our own getting caught up and to see others as mirror to that. And, you know, and then speak of mirroring, we can mirror something else back, right? So if we don't, then we continue to escalate that same kind of energy. But if we realize that this is also us, this is us at different times, we can take it in, process that, and then mirror something much deeper. Mirror back something much deeper. So it's all us. The clarity and confusion, the wisdom and the craziness, right? It's all us. That's what she's trying to say in that. Any comment? Yes?
Yeah, it's something about that. It's recognizing it, and then I think the move that I try to focus on a lot with that kind of scenario is trying to hold the space for them to kind of stumble through all that. And it's not like a, because I think about it of going, if I'm going through that, I often struggle to feel others holding the space for me. Like, you get so myopic in those moments where, you know, in my case, my first impulse is to kind of, you know, chastise myself for messing up or something, you know, and I feel like nobody's letting me just make a mistake and move on. Why is this happening? And then I realize that nobody is me the whole time, and it's not, I'm not on trial by anybody but myself. And so I tried to extend it in that. And I think I was listening to some podcasts, I forget what the specific topic was, but they were talking about children's ability to navigate through feelings of anger and stuff like that, and how much of an impact it can have on them if you kind of teach them that this is an undesirable emotion or something that they're not allowed to feel. And so then you grow up and you lack the capabilities and the tools to navigate through these very heavy things at times, mm-hmm. because you've been told you're not allowed to have them. And so it's trying to give somebody the space to feel comfortable in making that mistake, because I try, you try to see yourself in that moment of going, what would I want? What grace would I want extended to me? Because I struggle at extending grace to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully somebody would allow me to feel that, to give me the opportunity to awaken.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of, I think, what we're all trying to do here. It's not a sacrifice. It's quite the opposite.
See, it is the opposite, right? It may feel like that. It may be misunderstood as such, but no.
No.
Thank you. Anyone else? You want to say something? Okay. Yeah? Okay. So, yeah, just to sum that up is basically to see ourselves in everybody, right? So no matter how the other appears, right? It may be harsh, it may be obnoxious, right? But to recognize that we all get stuck, right? And then we work on getting unstuck. And even if we feel that we are able to somewhat liberate ourselves to some degree, it doesn't make us better then or different then, right? So any sense of liberation that we may have arrived at should help us see everybody as one, not separate us from others, right? If it separates us, then we're not using it well. Moving on to the next verse, when doing virtuous acts beyond reproach to help ourselves or for the sake of others, let us always bear in mind the thought that we are selfless, like an apparition, like a mirage or optical illusion, as Einstein called it. In the commentary, we can also make too big of a deal about doing things right. Right, identifying ourselves as the virtuous one can be a problem for the bodhisattva. We might question the solidity of this identity and contemplate the Buddha's teaching that we are selfless, like an apparition. Then, when doing virtuous acts, we could apply the instruction called threefold purity. Make no big deal about the doer, no big deal about what is being done, and no big deal about the result, right? So the triple emptiness, often we refer to it as no giver, no gift, no receiver. It's the same thing, right? No giver, no gift, no receiver. So, yeah, so to recognize that, but to recognize at the same time that it's not making me, right? In the same way that being stuck doesn't make me the one who is stuck. Being free or experience freedom doesn't make me the one who is free. Right? So if it does, that then it becomes the illusion, right? So what he's saying is to recognize that we are not what we, whatever we think we are, we're not what we think we are. So neither thoughts nor emotions create a self, basically, right? So moving on to the next one, this next section, Chandideva is talking about knowing how to treat our body as a vessel for goodness while not denigrating it and not obsessing over it, right? Neither one. Pay this body due remuneration. So payment, respect, honor, right? So give it what it needs. But then be sure to make it work for you. But do not lavish everything on what will not bring perfect benefit, right? So examine how you use your body. So if you're able to do so, you should pay this body respect, nourishing foods, medicine, or whatever else the body needs. But draw a line about how much time you spend at the gym, for example. right? It will also be wise to recognize negative attachments. Denigrating the body is as futile and as much a distraction as pampering. So we can look at this for a few minutes, right? How am I treating my body, right? Am I seeing it as a vehicle for goodness, or am I seeing it as something to show myself to use it to show myself to the world with, right? So how much energy am I giving to that? How much attention? What kind of attention? That's better. What kind of attention am I giving to the body? Obviously, taking care of the body means you care for the vessel for goodness in terms of practice, right? So it is important, it is vital that we give the body its rest, right? The rest it needs, the nourishment, exercise, or whatever it is. But then if we end up, what she's saying, the example of going to the gym, which is very common in our society, right? We go to the gym not for the body. We go to the gym for the image. Not always. But right, often we end up going to the gym and then we look at the mirror, is that what I want to present to the world? How do I look? Right? So then it's no longer about the body, it becomes about the illusion. So am I going to the gym for the illusion, right? So going to the gym and then taping myself working out and then posting it on Instagram. I'm not making this up. Some of you probably know what I'm talking about, but it does happen quite often, right? Then is it about the body? Obviously, it's about something else, right? So how do I treat the body? And then the other side of that, what she's saying, denigrating the body is as futile and as much a distraction as pampering, right? So ignoring the body, right, is also a problem. And this is, we can connect that to the Buddha's own path, right? His own process, basically, right? So he went from being a prince, right, in the palace, to basically letting everything go. And then he practiced asceticism for quite a while to a point of almost dying. That's denigrating. That's one way. I mean, there are other ways to denigrate. That's ignoring the needs of the body. Right? So he went from one extreme, indulgence, to completely ignoring, to not giving the body, from giving too much to not giving enough to the body. Right? And then obviously the middle way came out of that. Right? So not too much, not too little. Not too much, not little, with the leading aspect of that is what does the body really need? Not what does my image need. Do we connect with that? How? How do you connect to that? Go ahead.
I was thinking that at the beginning you were mentioning about the humility and modesty being paying attention to the moment. Mm-hmm. And I think everything else we've been discussing afterwards has a direct link to that. I mean, like even paying attention to what is exactly the needle, how much is too much, how much is too little. Mm-hmm. And it all comes from that attention. And it also, I see, you know, that sentence has the trap of what do we call humility and what do we call modesty, you know, like, because I mean, I remember Yosen like mentioning something about the smallness, you know, and it's about what is exactly that we call humility. And I think, you know, it's interrelated to, I mean, it's like, it's those things that define themselves, like one equals one, you know, and in this case, it's like the paying attention. If you're attentive enough to what's going on, there is a selflessness to it that becomes the humility we're talking about, which is not about like being humble in the sense of, oh, I don't just go and introduce myself, telling me about all the degrees I have or whatever. You know, it's not about that. It's way more spacious than that. It's that giving that space that you were talking before you know, how do you leave this space? And I think, you know, that it's an interesting thing because we all strive to have that connection.
Mm-hmm.
We are all failing, you know, because I mean, like, you get it, you don't get it. You get it, like, it's like the four vows at the end, you know, like, you strive to get reality, perceive it, but, you know, we know we're going to fail all the time. So in that struggle, though, you get better. And as you perceive more, your actions are, it's interesting because, I mean, I don't know what is the action that brings the best upaya to the moment, you know? But the more open you are, that action happens to be less of an action that leaves traces in your own kind of being. Like, it will leave, I mean, that any action have consequences, but like, it will not leave traces of how you feel about it, of how you continue kind of being attached to that moment or not. And that is, I think, you know, what ultimately we're trying to talk about is how do we bring that spaciousness, bring that humility, find that action that is the upaya that you need at that moment, and then verify that that action is actually coming from the right place by leaving very small amount of traces, or no traces at all, hopefully, on what happens later. And then it's like an action that disappears, and then like there is nothing else attached to that moment. And I think, you know, that is kind of what I mean, I'm listening over and over again in what you're saying in different aspects of that. And it's tough.
Yeah.
It is not easy to be connected that way all the time. But I think, you know, what you said at the very beginning, he was talking about the, it wasn't confidence, sorry. Paraphrasing, it's not confidence, it's trust.
Yes, trust or developing virtue, but trust.
Yes, the trust that you can do it, the trust that you can go through any emotion that is bringing, and then you can actually not attach to that emotion, and there is something else that you need to be doing, with, regardless of the emotion. And it's an interesting thing, because I mean, like, the this was on Wednesday. I have this kind of very heavy sensation of doom, but very heavy. It was like super heavy, and I just wanted to kind of go to bed and die. You know, like that's kind of, you know, the sensation is like, oh, it's just like I want to die. It's, you know, and
curl up in a ball.
Yeah, it's like, nothing. I don't want nothing. I just want to go. And I give up, and then it kind of keep going, and then it has to, you know, and it was a reminder of that kind of, this is, I need to give this sensation a space because it's kind of consuming me, like there is other things going on. And so then you see the flowers blooming, and then you see, I mean, it doesn't take it away, but it gives you the confidence of the space to keep going, and then until that sensation disappears. And as easy as it comes, it goes away. It's a very interesting thing. Because all of a sudden, I was connected to something, and then all of a sudden, I wasn't feeling like that anymore. But we are so entangled sometimes to those heavy sensations, regardless of what it is. I mean, sometimes it's too much joy, sometimes it's too much doom. But, you know, I mean, that's kind of what I'm gathering from everything that you
said. Right, so to acknowledge how we feel, right, and to not do anything, to not let that feeling determine the action, right? That's the point of acknowledging but not moving with it, right? So to remain still and silent means to acknowledge and then watch it and let it subside on its own time, right? And then the more we do that, the more we realize how things shift, right? And the thing is also with that, with what you're saying, is the recognition of nothing is stable. Nothing is stable. Nothing stays the same. We had an earthquake. We had a couple of weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
So you know, we didn't have that before. Now we have one more thing to worry about. Or not, right? Because nothing is guaranteed. There is no stability. We want what doesn't exist. Inside and out. I mean, so what you're referring to, right? So I feel that doom, whatever you describe, right? There are moments like that. And there are moments you feel elated, you feel happy, you feel excited. Mm-hmm. But nothing stays the same. It's the teaching. It's not even the teaching. It's reality. Reality is teaching us that nothing stays the same.
No.
Right, exactly. So are we good students of reality? Can we be good students of reality? Meaning learning from ourselves, right? Learning from our inner reality, right? And then whatever is going on around us, can we continue to remain students for life and just learn? Because the teachings are everywhere, right? So then, you know, you go through that, there is a low, there is a high, there is a low, there is a high, there is an evenness, and it continues. And then do not identify with any of it. That's what makes the difference.
That's
what you're saying, that's the challenge.
It is challenging.
Yeah, so that's the challenge.
It's hard to realize. I think, you know, trust is super important. The faith, that's the word we were using. Faith.
The faith, yes.
Yeah. Faith, it's like a word that for many years to me, it was kind of evoking maybe not the right understanding of it.
Right. Like,
but it's that faith on the ultimate capacities of just life is pressing through you.
Mm-hmm.
It is phenomenal because it gets you through. And it gets you through anything that's going on in a way that the faith gives that the space that you need. A place where everything is there, but you're not attached to any of it. I think it's a bit super.
Do you want to say something?
Yeah.
Go ahead, quickly, and then we finish.
Okay, so when you were talking about presenting an image and using the body properly, I was just thinking in terms of my own work as a teacher, not the body necessarily, but the mind, using the mind properly and the knowledge and its capacity in the right way, and not to present like a false image of what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
but to actually just let it come through you. I was thinking of that in terms of observation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the administrators come in and they watch you. I think this was the first year, it's my 10th year teaching. I think it was the first year that I've actually felt like I didn't need to present my mind in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And when they came in, and it didn't make me nervous when they came in, I just kept doing what I do. And, I didn't plan for them. It's helpful when you don't plan for them to come, because then you just come,
mm-hmm.
and then you're using your mind properly. You're using your knowledge and your wisdom properly with the kids, and you're doing what you're really supposed to be doing.
Right, so the attention in that shifts from wanting to appear a certain way. It shifts from me to the other. It shifts from the person to the situation. It shifts from wanting to present or protect an image to the question of what needs to be done. Why am I here?
Yeah.
I'm not here for me. I'm here to express something through me. I'm here to allow something to be expressed through me. Right? If we see it that way, then we can ease up on the me and then focus on reality. And that changes everything. So we need to wrap it up. Just one more thing I want to say about the how we look at the body, so, and everything is changing, to connect those two. The body is changing constantly. We age, right? And we find new wrinkles, and we find that we are not able maybe to do things we were able to do when we, like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, right? This is natural, right? And then we react, we look in the mirror, we react. And there is a problem with that, because we react, we don't like it, but what we're saying is, I don't like life. I don't like life. That's what I'm saying. I like my version of my own idea of life. But life itself, not today. Right? Well, I like it in certain days, but not today. Why? Because I resist this. I think it should be otherwise. And this is something we need to look at, right? We need to examine the gap between our expectations and reality. We live our lives based on a false idea that we create. And then, you know, to realize that life is the way it is, and then release the grasp on the idea is to experience liberation. It's the only way to experience liberation. Not by trying to stretch the skin and keep it from becoming wrinkled. That doesn't work. Sooner or later, it's going to become wrinkled. What does it matter if it's now or 5 years from now? What does it matter, right? In fact, the sooner I acknowledge it, the better it is, because then I have more life of liberation, or experience more liberation in my life. So the sooner I am making agreement with the fact that I am impermanent, that I'm fleeting, right? The better my life will be. And actually not just mine, the better other people's life will be too. Others who I happen to interact with. So just work with that. All right, so we'll continue probably next week. Thank you.